Yes, Your Honors. Good morning. John Lemon for Henry Michael Houston. I'm going to take 12 minutes total. I'd like to reserve 3 of mine for rebuttal. And
so 9 on opening and 3 on rebuttal?
Right. And Mr. Harris is going to take the remainder for Mr. Bridgewater.
Okay. And then we just have someone else sitting there?
No, that's Mr. Fleming. He's co-counsel for Mr.
Okay.
Houston.
Okay. So then, Mr. Harris, then that leaves him with 8 minutes. And were you saving any for a rebuttal?
6 and 2.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. Again, good morning. John Lemon for Henry Michael Houston. Your Honors, each of Mr. Houston's convictions must be reversed because the government introduced the most inflammatory and prejudicial false testimony imaginable. They presented a serial jailhouse informant who testified that Mr. Houston told him that if they didn't give Houston the death penalty for what they did to those niggers in Lewisburg, he would keep killing niggers and would continue to kill until somebody killed him. Now, this statement was undeniably false, and because the government allowed it to go uncorrected, we are left with any reasonable likelihood that it could have affected the judgment of the jury. This court must therefore reverse. And in fact, in previous cases, this court has stated that reversals under these circumstances are virtually automatic.
But let me ask you, the first question that I had was, I take it we're looking at this for plain error, right? There wasn't an objection made at the time?
Your Honor, actually, I believe this is preserved, and briefly, the reason why it's preserved is that after Prosecutor Martin testified in the penalty phase, Mr. Fleming specifically asked the district court to strike McConaughey's testimony because it was clearly perjured for purposes of the penalty phase. The district court denied that motion, and although he did state on the record that he thought that there was a very strong argument for perjury, he denied Mr. Fleming's motion. Now, as I'm sure Your Honors are aware, there's no obligation for defense counsel to continue to make fruitless motions once a definitive order has been given by the district court, and this court reiterated that last week in the Sepulveda case, where it stated again a definitive ruling. Once there's been a definitive ruling, the issue is preserved. However,
but when was it, the objection was made? After the statement came in, right?
Well, defense counsel suspected but could not have been certain that this was perjury until after Martin testified in the penalty phase. At that moment, that's when Mr. Fleming specifically asked for the relief that the testimony of McConaughey be stricken. So at that point, the issue was preserved. But even if we are in plain error, I mean, this is a perjury case. I mean, this is error. It is plain. It clearly affected Mr. Houston's substantial rights and also the integrity of the proceedings.
I mean, so let me just ask one question before we focus on the McConaughey. Is that how you pronounce it?
Yeah, I think that's how it's pronounced.
The question that came to my mind was we have the government introduced the testimony of Benton. Benton was one of their main witnesses. And he says, Houston was agreed to participate. He was going to kill people by himself in his unit. He came with me. We stabbed this individual together, Mr. Salam, together. Why doesn't any testimony by McConaughey, whether perjured or not, is non-prejudicial in light of this testimony from Benton? So that puzzled me.
Several reasons, Your Honor. First of all, the statement by itself is the only such statement attributed to Mr. Houston. He made no statements throughout from the date of the killings throughout the trial. He's never talked about this. This is the only statement alleged to have been made by him, and it is an apocalyptic statement, a grisly confession, which, of course, the Supreme Court has observed on numerous occasions is the single worst type of evidence that can be admitted against a defendant. But also, with respect to Benton specifically, what Al Benton testified to Al Benton took credit for the killings. Al Benton stepped up and said, "I killed Salam." He was asked a leading question on direct examination that started off, "After you and Houston killed Salam," and Benton interrupted and said, "I killed Salam." And Benton testified that he chose a 12-inch shank with a special handle wrapped with rope around it so that he could make sure that he killed Salam. When he walked into Salam's cell, he stuck him through the neck with that shank. At that time, Mr. Houston was outside the cell.
But he was being charged with he was guilty as a co-conspirator, right?
On the two Vicar counts, he was convicted as a co-conspirator, right.
And didn't Benton testify that Houston was with him and was armed with a knife and was participating. I mean, there certainly was enough for the conspiracy theory.
Well, Your Honor, what Benton said is that Houston was undeniably with Benton at the time, but Benton went into the cell first. Benton stabbed him. Benton said, "I worked Salam until I knew he was dead." At that point, Houston had already left the cell. So it's quite possible. There's no blood from Salam that was found on Houston. It's quite conceivable that Houston, to the extent he participated, stabbed a dead man already. And when Benton was done stabbing Salam, he walks out of the cell, and Houston takes his knife from him, disarms him, and throws his knife out the window. And Benton testified that had Houston not done that, he would have gone and killed more people. And so Mike Houston's involvement was relatively...
Well, but another way to look at that is getting rid of the evidence, too.
Well, perhaps, Your Honor, but that's not the spin that Alan Benton put on him. He felt that Houston disarmed him. And the thing about Mike Houston is he was not a member of the Aryan Brotherhood at the time. I mean, he's different than a lot of the other people who you've heard argument about today, because he was not a member of the organization. He was elevated after being made an offer that he couldn't refuse. And those were Benton's exact words. "I made him an offer that he couldn't refuse." The defense argued throughout the case that Houston participated, to the extent that he did participate in this killing, not in an effort to further the enterprise, but because he was under an element of coercion, that he was basically doing it to save himself as opposed to further a criminal enterprise. He received a battlefield promotion, if you will, after the killings. So that's why this certainly cannot be harmless. I mean, the most powerful...
So your argument is that the testimony of him being a co-conspirator with Benton was not so compelling compared to McConaghy's testimony.
Exactly, because McConaghy's testimony is the only testimony that puts him squarely into conspiracy. That false testimony, that false confession is, yeah...
And what was the statement? Did he speak about killing Salam, or what exactly was the statement?
McConaghy actually, and I didn't make this clear enough in the briefs, McConaghy actually perjured himself in two distinct respects. The first piece of the perjured statement is the grisly confession he attributes to Houston, that Houston said, "If they don't give me the death penalty for what we did to those niggers in Lewisburg, I'm going to keep killing niggers and continue to kill until they kill me." That's the first completely false perjured statement. The second statement is that not only was that statement made to him, but that he related it to Prosecutor Martin in Lewisburg, at ADX, circa 2003. So those are the two statements.
And so the government says, well, the defense has not, to this date, has not proven that those statements were false. You've raised an inference that they were, but you haven't shown that they're false.
Your Honor, again, this is not a garden variety statement. This is a ghastly confession, and I think that any reasonable person could not argue that there is any chance that McConaghy was telling the truth without blushing. I mean, this is unlike any of the cases cited in the government's brief, unlike any case that I've ever seen before this court. We have a serial jailhouse informant who was thoroughly impeached by a federal prosecutor. I mean, again, Mr. Martin specifically said that had the statement been made, he would most likely have remembered it. He certainly would have written it down, that he concluded from the interview that Houston did not confide in McConaghy, that Houston did not provide any details of the killings to McConaghy, that he did not unburden himself in any way. And then in August 2003, he tells Mr. Wolf that Houston did not, that McConaghy may have valuable information.
So you're saying that the inference is so strong.
Yes, the inference
that
is.
That you have to conclude, there's no other way to conclude that it was false. Is that your argument?
Among other things, but yes. He is thoroughly impeached by a federal prosecutor. We have the timeline, which I provided Your Honors with a demonstrative to show the sequence of events. The abrupt shift in the focus of McConaghy's testimony, initially it's on John Campbell, and then it shifts after John Campbell's death to Mike Houston.
Were you able to make that argument to the jury?
I did not represent Mr. Houston at the trial court. I believe that some of that argument may have been made to the jury, but certainly not all of it, and certainly not during the guilt phase, because the defense had not become aware of all the impeachment material until the end of Martin's testimony in the penalty phase. This also was a close case. The jury deliberated for 29 days.
You've actually used your time, so I don't want you to take all of your co-counsel's time.
Thank you.
Thank you. Can you put it back to 11? Thank you.
Good morning again. William Harris on behalf of Wayne Bridgewater. I'll just pick up on that last point that Mr. Lemon was alluding to. Why this testimony really made a difference than the McConaghy testimony. It was a close case. The jury was out 29 days on this case. Also, you have to take a look at the differential result among the three defendants. One of the defendants, Slocum, was unique in that Slocum was not implicated by this statement, by this slander. And Slocum was either acquitted or hung on all counts. So I think
the
court.
Bridgewater? I mean, Bridgewater was. That's your client, right?
Yes, I represent Bridgewater.
I mean, he wasn't mentioned in McConaghy's testimony either. But
he was, Your Honor.
Was he?
That was the point I wanted to go back to. He is literally implicated by this because the statement was.
All right, mentioned and literally implicated are two different things.
Okay.
Is his name show up?
His name, well, by inference, for this reason, let me try to answer that question. The statement is that Houston supposedly said if they don't give him the death penalty for what they, plural, meaning Houston, Bridgewater, and Benton, did to those, plural, D.C. blacks, namely Salam and Joyner. Well, Bridgewater was the other person. We're talking about Bridgewater, Houston, and Benton, and plural victims, Salam and Joyner. So I would submit to the court that literally, looking at the words what they did, the words they and those, this statement, this slander, literally implicates Mr. Bridgewater.
Now, Mr. Houston's lawyer is indicating that the impact of McConaghy's testimony relates at least in part to it's a confession. So that wouldn't be the case for your client, right?
True. The damage, the thrust of this is that Mr. Bridgewater did this for racial reasons. Our whole defense at the trial was that there was this war. They were ordered by Benton to take, that they had to get involved in this thing, and that there was an existing state of war with the D.C. blacks. These guys didn't do it for a vicar purpose, not to maintain or increase a position in a racketeering enterprise, but rather to survive, because these guys were coming after us. And that was Benton's testimony. So to say that the problem with this slander of McConaghy is that saying that Bridgewater, by implication, killed, not because he was trying to help himself, but because he wanted to get these guys, that there was a racial motivation with the D.C. blacks. So, I mean, obviously, in order for Mr. Bridgewater to profit from this argument, it has to implicate him. And I would submit just literally, you take a look at the words that McConaghy testified to, referring to Houston. He said, and this is at page 83 of the Houston excerpts, he said, if the government doesn't give him the death penalty for what they did to those niggers in Lewisburg, then as soon as he gets out of the control unit, he will kill more niggers, and he's going to continue to kill until somebody kills him. That implicates Mr. Bridgewater, use of the plural terms they and those.
They didn't get the death penalty, though, right?
He did not get the death penalty, but it hung as to both in the penalty phase. Just briefly, I wanted to touch on some of the other issues. We made a point on count 7 about the Pinkerton instruction being insufficient because it doesn't narrow down the subject group of conspiracies, possible conspiracies, to a Vicar conspiracy. And the government's argument was that you have to look at all of the instructions, and basically instruction number 34 cures the problem, because instruction number 34, which is the basic Vicar elements, talks about doing so for the purpose of the Vicar purpose of gaining entrance.
Well, you seem to be asking for, I'm going to take you in another direction briefly, that you seem to be asking for instructions on duress, second-degree murder, and along those lines. And what the struggle that I'm having with this from the standpoint that, sometimes there are crimes that they either are or they aren't. And that in these situations, the way that, all of the allegations are that you seem to be asking for self-defense, second-degree murder, duress, with the concept that because these are prison crimes, because of the stress that people are under, that we need to somehow extend the law to what would be, I would term to be the preemptive strike. I've got to kill them before they're going to kill me. What legal authority do you have for that?
Well, we're not arguing self-defense. We asked for a self-defense instruction, and Judge Carter denied it. But to answer your question, there was legal authority that we briefed that
issue. It just
seems
like they're either first degree. You're either guilty or you're not guilty. You're guilty of first degree murder or you're not guilty here. I don't see what facts here under the existing law would make it any, obviously in their minds, I can't argue with the fact that if someone's going to get them first before they get the jump on you, but there's nothing in our law that allows us to give instructions like that for the preemptive strike.
Well, I agree to some extent the law is not developed on that. What I argued in the trial court was we cited cases from international law where it works for countries.
So, would you concede if we were to accept your argument, we would be extending existing law?
I did not find any law when I was briefing this before Judge Carter allowing this the preemptive strike, and the answer to your question would be yes.
All right. Unless Judge Acuda has questions, I'm going to give the remainder
Thank
for
you.
Your rebuttal. Thank you.
Your Honors, I'd like to talk about just the facts for a minute or two.
Why not, just because we're on a different case, why don't you state your name again?
Stephen Wolf for the government, Your Honor. Both defendants assert that this is a close case, and that's a laughable proposition. As to Mr. Bridgewater, taken in the reverse order, Mr. Bridgewater stabbed Frank Joyner 36 times in front of Byron Ball, a black man in his late 60s who weighed 140 pounds, dripping wet, and was playing Monopoly with Frank Joyner when Bridgewater came in and killed him. Mr. Ball has died since in a prison in Ohio, but he was an eyewitness, and the case against Bridgewater as a result was overwhelmed.
Didn't Ball sort of catch a glancing?
He was stabbed by
by
Jason Schweihart.
Well, he had an attempted murder charge in one of the other cases that we did previously, I think. Wasn't that one of the predicate offenses in one of the cases we've done previously today?
Yes, Your Honor. It was charged in the same case, but Schweihart wasn't against Byron, the attempted murder of Byron Ball. There's an assertion here that it wasn't an attempted murder because Jason Schweihart wasn't shown to have the intent, that there was insufficient evidence because the blow wasn't to the heart or something of the sort. The evidence is overwhelming as to Houston for reasons that Mr. Houston really pretends aren't facts in the record. He was, the corrections officers responded to this very quickly. And the first one on the scene saw Mr. Houston leaving the scene of the crime and coming back from the range where he and Benton had killed Salam to the range where he hid out. So he was seen walking from the scene of the crime. That was by corrections officer Coombe. Mr. Bunch then saw both Al Benton and Henry Houston. Henry Houston, who didn't reside in that unit, locked in Benton's cell. He said they both had blood on their hands and both had blood on their clothing. Daniel Lockoff then came by and saw that Houston and Benton both had blood on their clothes and were both washing themselves at Benton's sink. Finally, Matthew Ettinger testified about the videotape that showed, this is the hole in the duress claims, Houston had to distract the guards in order to get from B block where he resided to A block where the murders were to take place. He was plainly away from Al Benton and couldn't have been under duress when that happened, and Ettinger showed Exhibit 72, the videotape that showed Houston sneaking into A block. Ettinger also said that he went around and looked at the defendants after the fact. Mr. Lemon carelessly said that there was no blood from Salam found on Houston, but Ettinger found blood spatters on Houston's face and took a photograph of them. The exhibit is 94. The testimony is on April 2nd, the first volume, page 49. The evidence is overwhelming. That is what, at the end of the day, determines that McConaughey's testimony, whatever it was, wasn't prejudicial because it really had little to do with the guilt, the plain guilt, in the penalty phase. Perhaps that's why Defendant Houston chose not to call AUSA Martin in the penalty phase, because the evidence of guilt was overwhelming and the interest of Mr. Houston and his attorneys in the capital case was to spare Mr. Houston the death penalty, so that they chose to bring their impeachment for McConaughey in the
penalty
phase.
What standard do we review the Brady and Mooney, is it Napui, claims?
Your Honor, the as to the Mooney Napui, it's whether it's prejudicial, and it's not perjury.
But is it de novo?
Pardon me?
Is it de novo? Do we review it de novo?
And is it plain error or not?
Well, it's plain error here because the preservation that defense counsel speaks of took place on August 8th, 2007, at the end of the penalty phase. It was not preserved before. It was never made the subject of a motion. The judge was never offered an opportunity to correct it prior to the penalty or the guilt phase jury. The point of preserving error is not an intellectual exercise. It's to make the objection and allow the trial court to do something about it. And there was never an assertion to the trial court in the guilt phase that the testimony was perjurious. Indeed, I think the only inference you can make is that Defendant Houston said, thank goodness for this witness. I'll impeach the daylights out of him. And they did. And I'll argue the daylights out of his impeachment. And they did. And then when they lost in the guilt phase, they said, I got to do something more. Now let's call the AUSA and see what we can come up with. The most striking thing about whether this evidence is perjurious is the inference that Your Honor points out. They have to make the argument is the inference that it's false is so strong it has to be perjury.
Isn't the inference pretty strong? I mean,
sure.
The AUSA says, well, yes, I would have remembered if he had said it, but I don't recall if he said it or not.
If Your Honor will give me a moment to explain this. This is so lovely. That is what the AUSA said. And the argument on behalf of Defendant Houston is that if it's so clear that you would remember, then it must be that it didn't happen. But there's an instance in this case given by defense counsel that shows that that's not true. Defendant Houston only, claimed in his opening brief that there was never any discovery about McConaughey's statement. But in fact, reports were given in January or early February of 2007, and on April 13th, 4 days before he testified, an email was sent out correcting or amplifying the prior agent's report, saying, you know, where the report says the reference was to D.C. blacks. In fact, I want to let you know he's coming up in 4 days. The real word he used was niggers. It went to all defense counsel. And Defendant Houston asserts in his opening brief that they received no discovery. They asserted that twice. The government showed in its answering brief that discovery was made in January, the email was sent on April 13th, and what do defense counsel say in the reply brief about why they represented falsely to your honors that there was no discovery? They say the false statement was, quote, based on the collective memories of trial counsel for the appellants, meaning trial counsel for the appellants in the plural. Four lawyers collectively did not remember that they received discovery in January, that they received an email on April 13th, and you should excuse us because we forgot.
So you're saying,
but they're saying here, if Fred Martin doesn't remember, it has to be perjury.
And so you're saying a strong inference is not enough to establish
absolutely
perjury. So we don't get into the Napui area. Can I turn your, unless you have any other questions on this, I wanted to turn to the jury instructions issue. Can you help me with these jury instructions? Because as I look at them, I'm having trouble seeing why there isn't an inconsistency between 34 and 36, where 34 says that in order to prove these Vicar counts, there's a requirement for the jury to find that the defendant did so for the purpose of enhancing their position in the enterprise, where jury instruction 36 says, as to co-conspirator liability, let me explain that it's not necessary for the jury to find that the defendant personally acted. So just walk me through it and help me understand why that is an inconsistency.
Well, Your Honor, I submit it's not an inconsistency because the instructions have to be taken as a whole. And
right, but even taking them as a whole, right, if one instruction says X and the other one says not X, so that we have a contradiction, we assume that the jury could have followed the erroneous instruction.
Your Honor, I think it's because the instruction 34, if I have the number right, the element instruction explains that maybe I should do it in reverse order. The instruction about co-conspirator liability says that the defendant doesn't have to carry out the act himself.
For that purpose. And so it says there has to be, somebody has to have done it for the purpose, but the defendant doesn't have to do it for the purpose, which seems to me an erroneous expression of what the Vicar statute says.
Your Honor, in the elements instruction, it says that paragraph 7 and 8 say that the defendant has to do one of several things. He has to commit the murder, aid and abet the murder, have co-conspirator liability, and then that the defendant did so for the purpose of gaining entrance to, so that...
So that's correct. But what about 36 then? So 34 seems to be a correct expression of the Vicar. That seems to be a correct expression of the law. But then help me understand why 36 is correct.
Your Honor, I'm not sure that 36 standing by itself is correct. It doesn't address the question.
And well, I think it starts by saying the defendant also may be found guilty of the Vicar offense alleged in counts 6 and 7 based on the law of co-conspirator liability. And then it goes through that, and then it ends by saying, and it's not necessary to find the defendant did so for this purpose.
But it's necessary to find that he did it for this for the purpose, it's necessary to find that he did it for the purpose recited in the co-conspirator liability elements, which...
I'm sorry, I didn't understand that.
Well, maybe I'm having trouble making this clear. It seems to me that the more detailed instruction is not contradictory, it's just silent on a question. And the silence, I submit, is not contradictory of the positive assertion in 34.
So how do I understand this language? Let me explain co-conspirator liability further. To find the defendant guilty based on co-conspirator liability, it is not necessary that the defendant personally act for the purpose of gaining entrance to maintaining or increasing his position in the enterprise.
The point of that is that the defendant, for co-conspirator liability, the particular defendant, may not have acted at all. That is, the defendant has to have joined the enterprise and have agreed that murders would take place, for instance, in furtherance of the enterprise's purposes, but the defendant doesn't have to have acted at all. The Pinkerton defendant,
right, says,
a defendant must have done so.
So 36 says that for co-conspirator liability, the defendant need not commit any overt act for the purpose of gaining entrance to or increasing status in AB. However, the jury would still have to find that the defendant conspired to murder for the purpose of gaining entrance, increasing status pursuant to the jury instruction 34. Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor. Although the defendant has to have agreed or conspired when he joined the enterprise that one of the purposes of the enterprise was, in this case, the only purposes charged were narcotics distribution and crimes involving murder. So the defendant had to agree that he was joining an enterprise that would kill when necessary and distribute narcotics.
But for these Vicar offenses, the only thing that's being charged is either aiding and abetting the specific murders of Joyner and Salam, or have co-conspirator liability for the murders of Joyner and Salam. And then correctly goes on to say, and you have to show that you did that, you conspired, if that's what they found, or you aided and abetted for this particular purpose. That's what 34 says, right?
Yes, Your Honor. The conspiracies, there's no evidence at all that there were any murder conspiracies or indeed any conspiracies involving these defendants that weren't Aryan Brotherhood conspiracies. So that the murder conspiracy is a conspiracy necessarily by the enterprise. The instructions would strike me as of more moment if there was an assertion, as Your Honors alluded to with Steve Scott in the earlier argument, that he might have attacked Irvin Bond for some other purpose. But there's no assertion of that at all. The only conspiracies that exist in the facts or that are alluded to at trial at all are the Aryan Brotherhood conspiracies to kill those who are threats to the organization.
So you're saying if there's an error in these instructions, it would be harmless? Is that what you're telling me, that potentially this is an inconsistent instructions, but any error is harmless because all the evidence showed that the murders were related to...
Yes, Your Honor. I guess I appreciate
the enterprise.
I guess that makes more sense than
what
I
say. I'm getting the impression that you're a little bit confused because you're not articulating it that clearly.
Well,
so there's nothing wrong with 34.
Yes.
There's nothing wrong with 34. So is there anything wrong with 36?
Your Honor, that's where my confusion comes from, I think. I did not see anything wrong with 36. I didn't think, it seemed to me that 36 addresses different questions, and it's just silent on this particular question. I don't find...
On what particular question?
The question of whether the defendant has to act with in furtherance of the enterprise when he does whatever he does that renders him liable as a co-conspirator.
It specifically says it's not necessary. I mean, how do I understand that language to say that it doesn't address that point? That's what I'm struggling with.
Well, as I said, Your Honor, I plainly am not, when I read these things, I didn't hesitate it over at all. So that I am plainly confused, and I may be, therefore, not addressing Your Honor's assertion. Okay.
So if you're confused, how wasn't the jury confused?
Well, because the jury hears that the defendants on trial here can be guilty because they're directly liable or they have aiding and abetting liability or co-conspirator liability. And either way, they have to do whatever they do for the purpose of gaining entrance to, increasing, or maintaining their position in the enterprise.
And that's instruction 34. That's exactly what 34 says, except it doesn't say directly liable. It's only for aiding and abetting and conspiracy.
It seems to me that it does say they could either have directly committed or aided and abetted.
Well, what 36 says, they don't have to commit an overt act.
That's because that's addressing the point that the co-conspirator doesn't have to have done anything in particular. The co-conspirator can be a member of the conspiracy in furtherance of its purposes when a different defendant
commits the overt act.
That's why I think the instruction says the defendant doesn't have to, it's not saying he doesn't have to do it with a particular purpose. What I think His Honor is getting at, and the way I think that the two make sense together, is that one instruction says essentially the defendant doesn't have to do anything. He doesn't have to commit an
overt act. Okay, so Houston and Bridgewater, Houston for counts 6 and 7 was found guilty as a co-conspirator, and Bridgewater on 7 was found guilty as a co-conspirator, I guess. Bridgewater on 6 was direct participant and a co-conspirator.
Yes, sir.
And so under jury instruction 36, it says you can find him guilty based on co-conspirator liability for this Vicar offense, and it's not necessary that the defendant personally act for the purpose of gaining entrance to, et cetera. So why isn't that just incorrect? And maybe I'm just repeating myself at this point. So,
and I'm afraid I'm obliged to repeat myself again. I think that the point of 36 was the point that the defendant need not, for co-conspirator liability, have committed an overt act at all. I think it's not, he need not have committed his act for the purpose. The real instruction is he need not have committed the act. That's the point. And it's shown by Bridgewater went into Joyner's cell and stabbed him 36 times. He didn't go into Salam's cell at all because after Benton recruited the co-defendants who were going to do the murders with him, they split up. He and Houston went and killed Salam. Joyner went on his own. Bridgewater went on his own and killed Joyner. Schweihart and Campbell went down and attacked Roberts and Webster.
Okay. Thank you for your argument. Okay. Mr. Lemon, you have 3 minutes.
Thank you.
And Mr. Harris, I said I would give you 2.
Your Honor, first of all, with respect to the weight of the evidence, setting aside McConaughey, the weight of the evidence against Mr. Houston, with respect to the killing of Salam and Benton's testimony, the salient point here is there was no blood found on Mr. Houston's clothes or on his knife, and the blood on Mr. Houston's face could have been Al Benton's. Benton testified at ER 112 that he does not recall specific blows being made by Mr. Houston, and he may have cut his own hand while he was stabbing Salam.
Does that really matter if he's there sort of shoulder to shoulder while they're murdering? Murdering someone?
Excuse me. I think if Your Honors are entertaining some sort of harmless error analysis for this Napoui claim, it's important to show that Mr. Houston was not as involved. The second point I wanted to turn to...
Well, that's a little bit like you can't have a drive-by without a driver.
Well,
you know, that's a drive-by shooting without a driver, and the driver didn't shoot the person, but you still can't have a drive-by without the driver.
Your Honor, the jury acquitted Mr. Houston of many of these counts. What I'm saying is that this was a closer case than the government would have you believe.
Okay.
With respect to the indicia of falsity for the statement itself, there were two other things that I would like to point out with respect to McConaughey's alleged confession of Mr. Houston. First is the abrupt shift in the focus of his testimony after John Campbell's death to Mr. Houston. Again, when McConaughey talks to Prosecutor Martin at the ADX in 2003, he attributes statements to John Campbell. In 2004, he testifies in Pennsylvania in a separate case. He's asked about cooperating. In this case, he's asked what he's cooperating about. He says statements made to me by John Campbell. In 2005, he testifies.
This goes to the strength of the inference.
Yes.
Right? Is that what you're arguing?
Right. And I just wanted to add that. In 2005, again, he testifies in this grand jury and talks about John Campbell. Doesn't mention Mr. Houston. Then the next point is we're talking about a serial informant with an admitted MO who requested 302s. He requested grand jury transcripts so that he could prepare his testimony. He testified against his crime in South Carolina. He testified. He's working off 107 years of exposure. Excuse me, I'm going a little fast, but I don't want to run out of time. He's working off 107 years of exposure. He testifies in Pennsylvania. He testifies in Illinois. He testifies against his own prison guard lover when he's caught having an illicit affair with her just so he doesn't get kicked out of WITSEC. And just recently in the Maxwell case, this court observed that these types of witnesses sometimes tell the truth, but more often than not, invent testimony and stray details out of the air. And that's quoting Judge Trott, a Law Review article that he wrote that was quoted in the Maxwell opinion.
You have 13 seconds.
Oh, I'm sorry. I've seen a minute 12 here, so
no,
I guess I don't have that luxury.
You started at 4, so
okay.
your time is almost up.
All right, Your Honor, the government says that defense counsel did not pursue a timely objection here, but I would just remind Your Honors that the government has an affirmative obligation to investigate perjury when they suspect it. At the time that Prosecutor Flynn redirected McConaughey, she knew that Prosecutor Martin had no recollection of the statement being made. She knew it wasn't in his notes, and instead she says to McConaughey and redirect, is there any doubt in your mind that Mr. Houston made these statements? And then she rehabilitates him with prior statements that were made after the motive to fabricate, improper prior consistent statements.
Okay, your time's up. Thank you. All right, Mr. Harris, you have 2 minutes.
Thank you. Just a brief point on the standard for this court on a Mooney-Napooley claim. Seems to me that it's a due process argument, and so the standard would be Chapman versus California, harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, in this case, Mr. Wolf said that it was, as to Mr. Bridgewater, was an overwhelming case, and so this couldn't make any difference. Well, if it was an overwhelming case, a jury wouldn't be out 29 days. This was a close case, and there's no. It's undisputed they were out 29 days. There's no way to explain.
They're out 29 days for the guilt phase?
Guilt phase, yeah.
And how long was the trial?
Trial was about 6 weeks, 8 weeks. Let's see, we started picking a jury in February, and opening statements were March, and the March 14, as I recall, and the case was argued to the jury early May 2nd. So, I don't know, 6 weeks. So, that says something about whether or not harmless beyond a reasonable doubt when the jury is out 29 days. I think that this kind of bombshell testimony could have made a difference. And you can't say that it was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. Thank you.
Thank you for your argument. This matter will stand submitted. Last case on calendar today is United States of America versus David Michael Sahakian. Case number 09-50226.